This is the second part of your third class, and we're just talking about the transit of Venus. The transits of Venus are among the rarest of predictable astronomical phenomena. They occur in a pattern which repeats every 243 years. Basically, you get two transits 8 years apart, and then a gap of 121 and a half years, or 105 and a half years. Now, I thought, well, why? Only 8 years apart? So you get transit, then 8 years, then transit, then 121 years, then transit, then 8 years, then transit, then 105 years. That's the cycle. And I wondered, well, why do you get only 8 years between them? And then it's actually a very simple idea. Yeah, if you imagine that's the sun, you have to look at me now. You imagine that the screen is the sun, and this is Venus. And it's going round all over the place, and then it's going round there and round there. So 8 years apart, you get one passing, crossing along the top of the sun, and then the bottom of the sun, and then missing the sun for a long, long time, and then going round, and one at the top, one at the bottom. So I actually understood why there's only 8 years apart. If you measure very carefully the transit of Venus from different points on Earth, you will see that the timing is different. Yeah, if you are thousands of miles away, then the difference in timing and position allow, because you've got the Earth, then Venus, then the Sun. If you have the view from one side of the Earth and the other side of the Earth, you can calculate the distance from the Earth to the Sun. You don't need to know the absolute scientific details of this. So they set about doing this. They set up a fort, defended. Notice that they were always there with the Marines, with the guns, just in case. They were always very... And they also sent somebody off to another island to also measure that. This was an international scientific experiment. And although Britain and France were at war, the British scientists and the French scientists got permission to cooperate on this. And indeed, the French government had instructed its navy not to harm the Endeavour, since, I quote, it was on an enterprise of service to all mankind. So this is an interesting idea. You've got a development of an international scientific community. Here you have the observations of the transit of Venus made by Cook and Forster. Is it Forster the other one? No, Green. Made by Cook at the top and by Green at the bottom. So you can see that he actually takes part in the scientific experiment, Cook. He doesn't just leave it to his scientists. It was not fabulous, the result. It was not as clear as they had hoped. But he does present the results to the Royal Society when he gets back to England. So he does have a bit of a scientific role. As he is leaving Tahiti, he gives his opinion of Tahiti. He says that Tahiti has nothing much worth trading, but it is a useful place to restock in the middle of the ocean. If you remember the map, Tahiti is a really useful place because it's in the middle of, well, nowhere really. They had on page 55 a celebratory dinner with the native chiefs because it was the king's birthday, and so they invited the natives to have a dinner with them. And they got information from the natives about the previous ships, which had come 15 months earlier, and one of the things that they had done is that they had brought venereal diseases with them, and most of Cook's sailors will also be infected. They had to repitch the ship, that is to remettre la du goudron pour le rendre à nouveau étanche, oui, voilà. So this is big work, and they were very pleased to discover that there were no worms in the ship, because worms is the ship is actually a very, very sophisticated piece of hardware for the time, but also very fragile. You get worms, you're in a bad way. Yeah? And they regularly, more than once, they take the ship out of the water, turn it over and reap it. It's a huge job. It takes a week. Yeah, and a lot going on. Some lashes going on here. One sailor got 24 lashes for stealing nails, and another got lashes for stealing from the natives. And for stealing rum. So it was time to leave Tahiti, and off they went. And if I was going to make my own little comments there on Cook, although there is obviously a general assumption of European superiority, Cook is not does not centre on stereotypes of savages. Yeah, he does think that European civilization is superior, of course. But he doesn't. He understands that the native peoples are intelligent and sophisticated. So they arrive in New Zealand, which has two names. The other one a little bit more difficult to pronounce, Aotearoa. But interestingly enough, today the First Nations name Aotearoa is more and more used. And very often, even in official documents, you will see the two names. So this whole question of the encounter of European civilization and languages with First Nations out there is not finished. In fact, I've been showing you with some of the newspaper articles. Every day there's something. And their arrival in New Zealand went very badly. They will spend quite a lot of time going all the way round New Zealand because they need to be sure that it is not attached to a huge southern continent. Yeah? Because they thought it was, yeah, that Tasman saw it. And thought, oh yeah, it might be. They got to speak with the natives, and they understood that it was an island, or it was a couple of islands, but they wanted to check. Their first meeting with the natives was not very happy. Here you have Parkinson's drawing of a tattooed Maori. I think it's from the second expedition. That doesn't matter too much. And indeed there are two words which Cook brought back to Europe. Tattoo and taboo. Those two words were brought by Cook. Tattoos had already existed in Europe before, not so sophisticated, but they do exist, not in quite the same technique. And taboo, it was interesting that they didn't have this word, because many things were taboo in Europe, but they didn't have the word. They wanted to speak with the natives. The natives were very unhappy, and on page 70, they killed one of them. I quote, "Just as he was going to dart his spear at the boat." So the native in Cook's journal was on the point of attacking them. He didn't attack them, was just about to attack them. And here, the problem here, of course, is we have no other accounts. So we can believe him or disbelieve him, but we can't prove it. In the footnotes in the Penguin edition, it points out that Cook rewrote this passage many times. So it does look like he doesn't feel so good about this first encounter where they kill one of the natives. And so he tries to present it again. Now that's all we know, that he rewrote it, it's all I know, we rewrote it several times. So there's obviously a difficulty there. The difficulty is becoming very visible this last few weeks. Last year, because they did a celebratory, 250 years later, the replica of the Endeavour came to the same place to commemorate the first encounter. And some of the Maori people were not so happy with commemorating it. And indeed, the British Embassy officially expressed regrets for the killing of the Maori 250 years ago. Today we know the names of some of the Maori killed through the that's kind of interesting. Yes, the British. So the British government expressed regret like 6 months ago, which is fascinating. At least 9 Maori are believed to have killed. The British High Commission. It's not the embassy, in fact, it's the High Commission because it's Commonwealth. This is what they wrote, the British High Commission. What we did today really acknowledged, perhaps for the first time, that 9 people and 9 ancestors were killed in those first meetings between Captain Cook and New Zealand Maori. Notice they say Captain Cook when he wasn't yet a captain. And that is not how any one of us would have wanted those first encounters to have happened. So, I continue the quote. It's a really significant part of our shared history. And this has become a whole part of the debate, shared history. Is it possible to have shared history? I don't know, it's a question. But certainly Cook took for granted that he had the power of life and death. He does, in page 72, say that he regrets the thing. And now I need a little help. Josephine, j'ai noté ici, la note de bas de page sur la page 72 est incroyable. Mais c'est tout ce qui est écrit. Alors maintenant, 72, can you give just the footnote?
Lost, they would of course have attributed, I don't know if it's attributed,
yes,
to their own bravery and our timorousness. Banks summed up these events by saying, thus ended the most disagreeable day my life has yet seen. Black be the mark of it, and heaven send that such may never return to embitter future reflection.
Okay, so what's interesting there is that Cook says, we had no alternative because if we had not done that, the natives would have felt that they won. So that's a fascinating thing. There's a question of honor and showing who is boss. And indeed, the Maoris, when they arrived, the Maoris were welcomed them with a dance, a haka, which is a traditional Maori dance. Unfortunately, Cook said, oh, well, this must be a war dance. But that's not the meaning of a haka at all. And so they were really, because they were so determined, and the whole colonial project was to find places, measure them, and check which ones interest us, they certainly had no space for trying to understand what was going on. And so they applied their own stereotypes. And said, oh, that's a war dance, so they're being dangerous to us. This is what Joseph Banks wrote about the haka. The war song and dance consists of various contortions of the limbs, during which the tongue is frequently thrust out incredibly far, and the orbits of the eyes enlarged so much that a circle of white is distinctly seen round the iris. In short, nothing is omitted which can render a human shape frightful and deformed, which I suppose they think terrible. Interestingly enough, then, the haka is in a very important part of Maori culture. From their arrival in the early 19th century, Christian missionaries fought very hard to eradicate the haka, which they saw as conflicting with Christian beliefs and practice. Henry Williams, the leader of the Church Missionary Society in the 19th century in New Zealand, aimed to replace the haka and the traditional Maori chants, the waiata, with hymns, with Christian hymns. And missionaries also encouraged European harmonic singing as part of the process of conversion to Christianity. And indeed, the haka today remains a tremendously important part of Maori culture. And indeed, perhaps you remember that terrible event a few months ago, where there was a mosque in New Zealand which was attacked by Islamophobes, and they killed a lot of people. And in the national commemoration, not commemoration, the ceremonies to mourn, they involved the haka very much so. It was very, very interesting. The New Zealand government is very interesting as well, because they also said, okay, after this massacre in this mosque, next Friday, we want the Muslim prayer to be done in the Houses of Parliament, which is... Yeah, which is different, yeah, which is different. So the haka. At 6 o'clock, we left the bay, which I have named Poverty Bay. And he calls it Poverty Bay because they didn't get what they wanted, but they did get a little further up the coast. They got 12 tons of water. That's good. But you should imagine how much work there is involved in getting 12 tons of water. They also got a lot of celery. They found in the woods trees of more than 20 different sorts of trees. And they were helped by the presence on board of a gentleman who I have not yet mentioned, Tupaia. This is the Tahitian guy who came along. So he was obviously quite adventurous sort. He wanted to join this bizarre thing. And obviously from our point of view, the presence of Tupaia on board is very important. He was a navigator from an oral culture, which we do not often come across. He had memorized a whole series of islands and how to get there. Research has shown that he knew of islands which he had never visited. His father and grandfather had passed on to him details of how to get to islands which in fact his people had not visited for decades, such as Fiji, Samoa and Tonga. Cook appreciated Tupaia's intelligence and worked with him to draw a map. Nevertheless, initially he did not want to have Tupaia on board. It was Banks who persuaded him, and it seems clear that Banks was keen to take Tupaia back to England as an anthropological specimen to impress his friends. And certainly Banks, in his diary, writes about Tupaia in ways which we recognize today as completely racist. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some of my friends have stuffed rabbits, but I have I'm exaggerating a little, but it really is that sort of tone. Tupaia turned out to be, and here's a book on Tupaia by Joan Druett. Tupaia turned out to be invaluable as an interpreter and ambassador at different islands. And here is the map which he drew with the help of Captain Cook. And I think I already explained to you that the idea of Tupaia's way of looking at the world was what mattered is how you got there and not where it was. And so if the wind meant that it took much longer to get to this island than this island, then you put on the map, you put it further away because it takes longer. Yeah. So the whole idea of north, south, east, west and absolute positions, that's not how it works. Which is logical, because you don't, if you're not going to write it down and you're going to keep it in your head, it's different. Because of course the difficult thing about writing, it's not just that they didn't have a writing system, but the writing completely transforms the way we see the world, because it orders it in different ways. They were lucky, because the Tahitian language is closely related to the language of the Maori in New Zealand and several other Polynesian languages. But they were unlucky because the languages have no connection, or almost no connection, with the languages of Australia. And there you have some of the peoples and languages of the southeast of Australia. Huge number of languages. Because remember, first of all, as you know, Australia is big. And it was bigger, because you have to go by sea or by land, like walking or on an animal. So it's just a long way. There's no roads to speak of. So yeah, everything's a very long way, and so the languages are quite different. From 1814 onwards, missionaries invented a way of writing down Maori language in the Latin alphabet. Like many of the crew, however, Tupaia would die on the last stretch of the first expedition. When they left Batavia, present-day Jakarta, many died of dysentery. And when he died, Cook does say complimentary things about him in his journal. Tupaia was not the only Polynesia to have had close dealings with Europeans. Bougainville, a couple of years earlier, brought a young Tahitian to Paris. Ahutolu, this is a drawing of him. He came to Paris. He was the talk of the town and the toast of the court. He was presented to the French king and queen at Versailles and apparently learned to love the opera. 2 years later, a ship took the man back to Tahiti. But unfortunately, he died on the way there. Just with Tupaia, this is one of Tupaia's drawings. It's a drawing of Joseph Banks on the right. Exchanging fish for cloth. On page 88, we see more of this. One of the natives stole a piece of cloth. Mr. Gore killed him. And here is the quote from Cook. "It did not meet with my approbation because I thought the punishment a little too severe for the crime." I quote. Now, of course, the expression "a little" is rather shocking or funny or both. But even without the "a little," the question is, you can see that the officers have a lot of freedom. He doesn't say, I'll arrest him. And indeed, Cook was in a rather unusual position because he was the social inferior of Joseph Banks. Which would not normally be the case. Normally the captain came from a high class. Yeah, and this is why the person who has the best cabin on the Endeavour is not Captain Cook. It's Joseph Banks. I will show you his cabin when we get to the ship. On this bay, there is no sign of cultivation, and Cook imagines that they live on fish. They bought a lot of celery and oysters, and I found that very interesting that they had celery, because there are some plants which did not travel with humans, and some which did. Yeah, and there's been very little contact with other continents. And so celery appears to have gone, like dogs. All the islands seem to have dogs. So it looks like humans traveled with dogs always, which is interesting. Then he looks at some of the more shocking habits. For example, the Maoris are in the habit, after a battle, of eating their enemies, eating the dead enemy when they've been killed in the battle. So this is a form of cannibalism, but not to be compared with the stereotype of just eating people because you like eating people. No, it's part of the defeating the. And it is something which I think must have been very shocking for Cook. But at the same time, like I say, when you have public hangings and people are hung, if they steal a sheep, they can be hung. So, there are many shocking things around. And this is the point where I took formal possession of the place in the name of His Majesty. Yeah, so from then on, in the opinion of Cook, New Zealand belongs to them. And he goes around naming things again. "I have named this mountain Mount Egmont in honor of the Earl of Egmont." So and this is the habit of naming, which is rather unusual. If you imagine I came to your house and said, "Oh, that cat, I think I'll name that cat Sugar." Well, you would say, "What do you mean you'll name the cat? It's got a name." Whereas, of course, in this situation, there was not an equivalent power. So they just had to put up with it. And Mount Egmont is still called Mount Egmont today. But the situation is changing. The case of New Zealand is no doubt the best known, is that in some cases they have instituted an official dual naming policy. Since the 1980s, but remember that from the point of view of a historian, the 1980s are quite recent, the Geographic Board has changed the names of a number of New Zealand places to include the original Maori name as well as the name of European origins. Many of these renamings have been as the result of settlements after the Treaty of Waitangi, which we will be talking about later. This is a treaty between the Maori and the New Zealand government, which solved some of some conflictual problems. The new names given today have two forms. Either they are dual names, like Mayor Island Tuua, they just keep the two names, yeah? A name from England and a Maori name. Or sometimes they are alternative names, such as Whanganui or Whanganui. They're very close, yeah? Just in two languages. In the case of the dual names, official bodies must use the double name. So any university or government, if there's an official double name, for example, Mount Egmont, which I just remembered and which you should see, there it is, Mount Egmont, it's important to see it, is Mount Taranaki, Mount Egmont today. This is its official name. Taranaki means apparently shining peak, whereas...
It's usually
snowy.
Snowy, yeah,
okay.
It's very snowy.
Oh, well, that would explain it.
Yeah.
And Egmont is the first Lord of the Admiralty. Basically, Cook named the mountain after his boss. Yeah?
The local king is still called, there's a mountain called the
Lighthouse.
And there's the king is named Egmont. That's what rang a bell over there.
Ah, yes.
Mentioned it.
Yes, interesting. So now we have this, double thing, yeah? So unsurprisingly, the names fared in proportion to the power involved. And so in 1986, it has two officially equivalent names. From 2020, under a recent treaty settlement, the mountain will be officially named Taranaki Munga. So it's losing the Egmont in 2020. You know, you see that, as they say, you know, history is what was it? History is never really finished. It's not even really past. Yeah, and it's still continuing here. And I'm giving you a lot of details about this one mountain named by Cook, but there are many dozens of other examples. I'm not going to give you all the examples, which have been involved in negotiations between the New Zealand government and Maori peoples. Here we have a few typical examples. And you can see some of the problems there. Some of them have alternatives. For example, Cape Kidnappers, which Cook named Cape Kidnappers because there had been an attempt to take one of his officers. Also to Kawa Amaui, yeah. But you can see the, I don't know, the political side of, imagine having a place named, well, I like the other one actually, Cape Runaway, this is still the name. But you can understand how, I mean, there is a funny side to it, but you can understand how for Maori people this can be really not funny. That, you know, that for hundreds of years it's being named Cape Runaway because this lost European came and frightened people by grape shot. Yeah. Wanakahike, Hicks Bay. Yeah. So this is just a small number. There are many more, but it's the principle and what it shows about colonial attitudes. And it shows a lot about colonial attitudes, and also it shows a lot about the presence of the history today. That the negotiations are still going on, and I'm sure that Cape Runaway in 30 years will not be called Cape Runaway, because the process is still happening. This is a European habit. Bougainville also travels around naming places. And indeed, if you look at the names, other names, you can see the colonial tradition. New South, when he gets to Australia, he will call it New South Wales. Remember that when the English got to North America, they called it New England. So the colonial project is very clear. Yeah, they're using the same methods. Yeah. Cook says in so many words at one point that New Zealand would be a good place to colonize. And he gives a reason. He says New Zealand would be a good place to colonize because the natives are so divided amongst themselves They will not be able to resist in a united fashion. That's not a quotation. It's the meaning of what he said. So here, one of the difficulties of the journal is that for quite a few pages, nothing much happens. And so sometimes there's one sentence really important and you miss it. So he even suggested which points would be a good idea to go for. And one final thing here is there you have Cook's chart of New Zealand, and we have a little here is Cook's chart of New Zealand. If you notice, right, there's two big islands and a very small island here. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yes, and if you can see that on Cook's map, it is a peninsula. It's not an island. It's linked. And this is absolutely fascinated. Say again? It's not. No, it's definitely an island. And for a very, very long time, people say, oh, it's funny that Cook made this mistake. But also, if you look at it, you can blow it up. It doesn't look right. It's just like two lines drawn to make the island not an island anymore. And so something is going on, and one researcher found the answer to this. And this is this lady, Margaret Cameron Ash, who wrote this academic article, Political Captain Cook. This article, just 5 years ago, 2014, this article compares two complete charts of New Zealand made by Captain Cook. One, which is extraordinarily accurate and was delivered to the Admiralty on his return in 1771, but remained unpublished for decades. And the other, which contains a major error and was published in 1773 and many times since. This article reviews Cook's journal entries relating to their compilation. And this article argues that in the light of the rivalries of 18th century Europe, Cook's error was not a mistake, as historians have always believed, but rather a deliberate misrepresentation authorised by the Admiralty. What she says is that when small islands are extremely useful for anybody trying to invade or attack, and so her argument is that it was in the interests of the British not to let anybody know that there was a small island there. Now, of course, we can't absolutely prove this, although her argument is quite good because there is another map he drew which is accurate, which shows it as an island. But this is something, the two fascinating things about this, first of all, what it shows about the imperial rivalries, and secondly, what it shows about the historian, where suddenly you ask a new question and you say, what if it wasn't a mistake? And that's where, if you come back to the map, you see, like I say, the island is just an island and then two light lines, completely straight lines. It doesn't look right for a peninsula. And so 45 years later, the historian finds a new look at it and gets something new, which is every historian is always happy there. Banks was having a good time at this time. He bought the head of, they used to keep the heads of their enemies. And so he bought one of the heads. Oh, I'll have one of those, yes. So, the head of your, could you just, and in fact, for your homework, next time I would like you to bring me the head of one of your enemies. Is that okay? Yes, maybe, maybe not. Also, at this point, they were working hard at drying the powder. They have, these muskets, you have to put powder in and then put the bullet in. It's really quite hard. And of course, if the powder is wet, and on the ship it is wet, so what they had to do is regularly, every few months, they had to take the powder out onto the side, find some way of putting it into the sun to dry the powder, because wet powder is not very good. Another example of a murder. Some of Cook's men had wounded one native and killed another a week before, but Cook was not aware of it. You remember they're not putting everything they do on Facebook or Instagram. And Cook says, I quote, "I found the reasons for firing on them are not very justifiable." So there are moments when he criticizes the use of firearms, but nevertheless there's no question of him punishing them for firing. He now plans to travel home via South America, but first of all he's going to follow the east coast of New Holland. By this time he has been all the way round New Zealand. I'm not giving you every event, yeah, because he actually drew that complete map. Now, apparently, apart from that mistake at the bottom, apparently it is a very good map. He really was good at this. Some of his maps were still used 200 years later. In fact, I have a world map at home in the living room, in Planisphère Ordinaire, and at the bottom, see, this part was drawn by Cook. It's just what I bought in France last year, yeah, and there's still Cook on the maps, which is quite impressive. Okay, so off he goes then into Botany Bay, arrives in Australia, New Holland. It's still called New Holland. And the first meeting with Australian Aborigines, and the quotation from Cook's journal is, "All they seemed to want was for us to be gone." So a rather unfortunate quotation there. He still is writing for the Future Navigators. He gives technical instructions on how to sail into Botany Bay. And he talks about the water birds that they were unfamiliar with, describes them. And this is where they come across huge numbers of oysters, mussels, cockles. So seafood. So this is when you have been eating salt beef. Yeah, a bit of seafood is well worth having. The natives are apparently all naked, but sometimes painted. And up they went north beyond modern Brisbane. And in the television series, which I know you, Karine, you've looked at some of the ship, they follow this entire route. And I think it is, it probably is impossible to feel like you were an 18th century sailor. But I think that the series is good because it does bring some of the questions down to a very concrete level. In the footnotes, we learn that one of the sailors deserted and never came back. I don't know if we find out every time that somebody deserts. We find out a few times when they desert and they are captured. But in this case, that we have a deserter who never came back. But this is interesting because you need to remember he's very much a military man. You're not allowed to leave. So the job of the sailors is not an ordinary job. In an ordinary job, you're allowed to leave. Okay, you don't get paid, but you're allowed to leave. And this, no, you're not allowed to leave. They managed to find a lake and some fresh water. And then on page 139, then they have a very, very difficult time because they hit the Great Barrier Reef. Now, of course, they don't know they have hit the Great Barrier Reef, and they don't know that it continues for many hundreds of miles north, and that they have chosen one of the most difficult places in the world to sail around. And indeed, they had to throw a lot of things off the ships. They threw 40 to 50 tons of things off the ship, including some of the cannons. And of course, first of all, they throw off what's heavy, but finally they get rather desperate and they get throwing off everything. Now, some of it they may get back with a small boat later, but a lot of it they couldn't get back. But they didn't have any choice because they were just all going to drown. Yeah, and so they said, oh yeah, let's throw that off, you know. They almost sank, and there was a big leak in the ship, and on page 141 you get some of the science of plugging leaks in ships. So if you're planning and going off on a ship, and you might need to know, it was quite ingenious actually, but there's actually quite a big hole, and they managed to find a way of plugging it for enough time to get back. And so they're finally safe again. They find things to eat. They find wild yams. And they found coconuts and lots and lots and lots of fish. We're now on page 148, lots and lots of fish. And interestingly enough, he mentions here that they share out the fish equally. When they bring in the whole load of fish, everybody gets the same. The gentleman, the captain, the sailor, the marine. Which is interesting because, I'm sure you've understood by now, this is not an egalitarian society, and not even a democratic society, because a democratic society is not egalitarian, but everybody has the right to their opinion. But nevertheless, this seems to be some sort of... I don't know where this comes from, this idea of sharing out equally, because the captain could quite easily say, double for the gentleman. Nobody would argue. It's not, you can't kind of argue. But it seems to be a sort of sea tradition, a very interesting idea. And so obviously it's very motivating for the sailors. And this was a lot of fish. They got a lot of fish each, you know. He sent some people off hunting and they found giant turtles. More than 200 pounds each one. So like 100 kilos. Which is tremendously good news if you're hungry, and apparently turtles are delicious. Have you ever eaten any turtles? No, me neither.
No,
of course, yeah.
Ah, right, okay. They fish them anywhere with like something traditional. Uh-huh. And they have it like special occasions, but they...
It's kind of secret.
Yeah, it's kind of secret.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, the giant...
So,
can you bring some along with the head of your enemy?
If I really wanted
some,
I knew how to
get some. Oh wow, that's incredible! Yes, I would love some. The giant turtles at the time were not a protected species, so Captain Cook was not in the wrong to eat the giant turtles. And they do see some Australians. Or some New Hollanders, some natives, but they are unwilling to approach. Finally, they will arrive, the natives, and they are rather disappointed because Tupaia does not understand a word. They say nothing at all. Because the population of Australia, fascinatingly, there was only one migration. About 60,000 years ago, there was a migration from Asia to Australia, but only once. And they know this because when they study the DNA of Australian Aboriginals, they would know if there had been like every 10,000 years an invasion, like there are in many parts of the world. So that's an accident of history, you know, because you could easily have. There could easily have been 10 over 60,000 years. And that also puts the Australian Aboriginals in a very different place culturally, but also politically, because the Maoris of New Zealand see themselves as immigrants. They came a few hundred years before the Europeans, whereas the Australian Aboriginals were there for 60,000 years, and so they don't like being told that their land was empty, funnily enough. This is where they see for the first time a kangaroo. And I don't know the real story of this. Somebody told me that they asked a native what the animal was called, and they said kangaroo, which means I don't know. But this may be a myth, this may not be a true story. So I wouldn't say that, you know. It's a rumor. Yeah, I'll try and find out the truth. Yeah. It's a rumor. Yeah. That's when Cook went up on a hill on an island, and he saw the massive coral reef, and he understood. Ah, oh dear, this coral reef goes on for hundreds and hundreds of miles, and he was worried because he had only 3 months' provisions on board. And so they moved forward very, very slowly with a smaller boat in front, 50 yards in front, the smaller boat with the lead on the string. Oh, no, it's too narrow here. Just a minute. Move 100 yards. It's okay here. Bring the ship a bit further forward. Horrific way of having to navigate it. And finally, on page 164, Cook says how proud he is. We have sailed 360 leagues without ever having a man out of the cleans heaving the lead when the ship was on its way. Donc on a fait toutes ces 360 leagues sans en ayant à tout moment quelqu'un dans le bateau devant qui mettait le plomb pour voir qu'elle était la profondeur. That's important because I think if you just read through it, you probably didn't understand it the first read through there. Yeah, and so very impressive feat of navigation. Although, as you may have noticed, my opinions on colonialism are not the same as Captain Cook's. Nevertheless, he was an extremely good navigator. He really was good at it. And there is an amazing technical account in 166, on page 166, an amazing technical account of the rough sea. He really is a technical expert in sailing and so on. Now, he's lucky because the modern ships allow him to sail quite easily against the wind. 200 years earlier, most of the ships could not sail against the wind. That's quite important. I don't know technically how they do that. On page 168, he mentions that he is a little worried about his image. It's an interesting point. So we do try to do a little bit of analysis of Cook's character, attitudes, and psychology. We can't go too far because I think it's difficult for us to imagine what an 18th century military man would think like. A lot of the positive biographies of Cook go into pop psychology, just like La Psychologie de Comptoir. That they say things, but they really don't know. But he's worried about his image. He says that when you're an explorer, you don't want people to think that you were being too cautious. Oh, he could have found out much more if he dared, but he was too scared, so you don't want that image. On the other hand, you don't want an image of somebody who is too foolhardy, taking unnecessary risks. Now, this will be perhaps certainly the case in the Barrier Reef on the second expedition when he goes south into the ice. It's like, let's go a bit further because it looks interesting. On the other hand, we might all die. Yeah, so it really is extremely dangerous. He names then New South Wales because he thought it looked like the coast of South Wales, and he goes round the top of Australia. Now he's gone up this page 171. He's gone up all the right-hand coast of Australia. He's got to the top. And so he is delighted because first of all he has proved that New Holland and New Guinea are not contiguous. That is that there is a space between New Holland and New Guinea. And also he's delighted because now there is open sea to the west. He has got to the top of Australia. Now sailing from the bottom of Australia to the top of Australia, even today, it's a long way. I remember the first time I went to Australia, I've been twice to Australia, and it was how big Australia is, but when you're flying, you're in the aeroplane and he says, yes sir, we're just arriving on the coast of Australia now, we will arrive at our destination in 7 hours. So it takes 7 hours to fly across Australia, which I think is just amazing in itself. So he names the island Possession Island. This is the place where he took possession. And he names the straits, Les Trois, he names it Endeavour Straits. He gives also very much then some. He gives details on page 173 how he calculates longitude and latitude. And finally, with some difficulty, because he's very angry at the bad maps which they have. He has gone there with. Now he's getting to Indonesia, places which are already known. And he's gone with maps which other people have made, but they're not very good. So you have a map and you look for the island which is on the map and it's not there. So he arrives at Timor, but very angry at the maps. And they arrive at the Dutch settlement in Timor. This is Dutch Indonesia. This is the Spice Islands. This is where the spices come from. And the spices are extremely expensive. When the English do trade with the Spice Islands, the sailors who unload them in London are not allowed to have any pockets because a handful of nutmeg is worth the equivalent of a few thousand euros. It's extremely. Now, I think this is because in a time when you have no fridges and no freezers, Spice for preserving meat is extremely useful, but hard to get because it only grows in these islands which have been colonized by the Dutch. And also, they won't let anybody take it to see if it grows somewhere else. They want the monopoly because it's worth so much money. So they speak with the king and with the Dutch governor, and they have to leave hostages there before they speak to him. And they're kind of lucky there because two of Cook's men speak Dutch. He has two sailors who speak Dutch. This is not because they went to university and did Dutch studies. It's just because, you know, sailors, well, they move around, you know, and quite a few of the natives spoke Portuguese, and some of Cook's men spoke Portuguese. Now, he's got about 80 men, and he's got two who speak Dutch, two who speak Portuguese, so probably more who speak other languages. Now, not a large number, but nevertheless, this is interesting to think of what kind of, maybe they are Dutch, or their father's Dutch, or something. Sailors are more cosmopolitan than most trades. You know, the farmers of Sussex, you know, their grandfathers were farmers in Sussex, and so at the time, whereas sailors has always been, and that was part of the excitement of there. So what did they buy? They had to buy stuff there and charge up. They bought 9 buffaloes and a lot of birds and some syrup. 9 buffaloes? Oh, let's have 9 buffaloes. Now, quite often, they kept, these were live animals, usually, and they kept them in a very small space, of course, but they kept them alive and killed them one by one so they got fresh meat, yeah? They were probably more or less tied up, the animal. It wouldn't be a lot of fun for the animals. But then, not a lot of people were having a lot of fun in the 18th century. So you know, it's kind of life. Then they went to Java, but before they went to Java, Captain Cook asked everybody for their logbooks and journals and hid them away, and they insisted that they should remain secret because the Dutch are, of course, imperial rivals. And indeed, when the Dutch commander comes on a social visit, in page 178, Cook refuses to speak with him because he does not want to accidentally give away secrets. So they arrive at Batavia, which today is called Jakarta, and they found some English ships. And they look at their own ship, and the carpenter says, "Oh my God, we need enormous repairs. And it's going to take them several weeks to repair the ship properly." There's also a little bit of science there. I'm going to finish in a minute. With a little bit of science there, there was a lot of storms and lightning, but they were okay because they had an electrical chain. I've forgotten what it is. It's a really simple word in French. What do you do to avoid your house being damaged by the lightning? Exactly, un paratonnerre. And this on a ship is an electrical chain from the mast, yeah. And Cook says all ships should have them because it's very useful to protect against lightning. And these lightning conductors, paratonnerre, were invented 20 years earlier in 1752 by Benjamin Franklin. You didn't know that, did you? Well, I didn't know 2 months ago. Yeah, but it's a great story, isn't it? Did you learn it at school?
Yeah, when I was little.
My goodness me. Did you go to school in the 18th century?
19th.
19th, okay. Okay. And at this point, they sent a letter via a departing Dutch ship to the Admiralty. So he sent a letter explaining some things, but not with the journals, because it's a Dutch ship. And when they arrived in Batavia, there were hardly any sick people. Almost nobody was sick. And so he was very proud of that. And we've got as far as page 180. And we will be continuing next time. Oh, a long time in the future, sometime in the dates which we just defined.